Hi, everybody. I'm Marcia Wallace, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1981. I'm an active member of the Living Life One Day at a Time group in Duluth, Georgia, and my sponsor is Maggie H. from the Atlanta Biscayne Room. And if I don't say anything else today that means anything, I think that's probably the most important thing that I can say. I don't know about you people, but I am absolutely exhausted this morning. I went to the room last night right after the meeting because I intended to get a good night's sleep and said I'd be less than nervous this morning. I'm always half crazy anyway, but I watched Billy Graham on 2020, and I've always just respected that man with every fiber of my being. And he was talking about dying and going to heaven, and I just thought that was wonderful. I believe in him, so, and what he has to say. And fell off to sleep around midnight, and one mistake I made yesterday, I didn't eat much yesterday, hardly anything at all, and I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning hungry, just starving to death, and I didn't have anything in the room to eat except a little thing called a power bar, and I wrote it down because this is what I want to tell you. So I mean, I was hungry, so I decided to just take a bite of the power bar. This morning I read what was on the front of it, and it said, power bar. Fuel for optimum performance. Athletic energy food. Well, I just came awake, you know. And I want to recommend that to any of you young people or any of you old people in the middle of the night. You know, that's a pretty good deal. But that woke me up. I mean, it was like, why did I do this? And then, of course, that storm started at God knows whatever time. And that just, it became humorous after a while because I'm scared to death of storms. And I'm sitting up there on the top floor on that corner, and I hear that wind. I think is that a civil defense alarm? What am I supposed to do? My grandmother, one time when I was a child, I was spending the weekend with her, and we were out in the country, and the storm came, and she made me get up and get fully dressed. She said, if a tornado is going to take me away, I'm going to be fully clothed. And I remember she put her pearls on, and you know. So I thought, should I get dressed, or what should I do? Where are the stairs? And then I thought, well, I'll read my prayer and meditation books early. You know, this is like 5 o'clock, no sleep. And I got to read this to you, too, because my God Calling book today, the title of it is Kill Self Now. Well, and it talks about killing self. And I thought, well, okay, that's not good. This doesn't sound too good. And then the other book I read, it had the same kind of message. And I'm wondering, well, what am I supposed to be doing? Do I want to turn on the TV because I'd blow the power out of the building? You know how we are. I just take a thought and go with it. Just fly with it. And it was getting worse. And then I thought of that old cynical view of prayer. You know, it's the last refuge of scoundrels. So I started praying. And finally, though, you know, the dawn came and the storm calmed down. But I'm just real grateful to be here this morning. I'm glad, and I'm real glad. And I appreciate y'all coming, too, getting up. I don't know if I get up this early in the morning to come hear me. But I got my little angel. Policy that gave me an angel that I carry with me, and somehow that makes me feel more comfortable too. But it is a privilege. It's always a privilege to be up here because, like I said, I'll be I'm almost 16 years sober, and that's talking about celebrating a miracle. I look at Bill Roof. I always love. Sorry, I said your last name. Bill R. He's sitting out in the audience. But I remember when I first came in the program, and I was so confused. I was just so sick. And I'd sit next to him in meetings, and he would always tell me, he said, now, if you haven't had a drink today, you're a winner. And I never could understand that because I had lost it, everything. And I just see so many people here. And, Pat, I want to thank you for having me and everybody. And that precious Vicky, she's so adorable. I make a new friend every time I go somewhere, and she's delightful. And this is good to be here this morning. I know that as in all of our experiences, we, you know, life ebbs and flows, and experiences come and go, and times are good and times are bad, and that's what life on life's terms really is all about. And I never knew how to live life that way, and I was always trying to make everything just fit so that I could live comfortably or live at all in this world and in reality. But I was thinking not too long ago how the last year has just been incredible. I don't call things bad or good anymore. I think they're just challenges, and things come and go, and good times always follow what are difficult times. But the last few months have been real hard for me because I'm one of these people that I was never strong emotionally, but I've always had strong emotions, and I do tend to react and respond to things in pretty dramatic ways sometimes, but The past few months have been tough. On Christmas Eve, I lost a family member who I loved as much as I've ever loved another human being, and she was really the only family member that I had ever consistently had a relationship with that involved nothing more than just unconditional love. She loved me no matter what, and somehow I could respond to that. And she died of a heart attack on Christmas Eve, and that's still really painful because next Friday will be her birthday. But different things. My dad has been seriously ill the last couple of years. In fact, he's dying of Parkinson's disease. It's kind of taken him inch by inch, and that's been real painful for me because my daddy's real important to me, as a lot of women, how we are about our daddies. But I've been able to be a good daughter to him, and to be there for my mother, to develop a relationship with my mother thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you've taught me how to do. But that's difficult because it's an ongoing thing, and it's kind of open-ended, and we never know from day to day what's going to be going on. It's a blessing to be up here this morning because my husband, who is also in this program, he's 18 years sober this month, had a heart attack 3 weeks ago, and we almost lost him. And that was pretty much of a... it's painful, but it's also... We were blessed because he lived through it. He's one of these types, though, who's going to do everything himself. And I was out of town at the time, and he actually was having a heart attack and drove himself to the hospital having a heart attack. So this is the kind of guy I'm living with, so we're both going to try to outdo each other one way or another. But tomorrow we'll be celebrating 12 years of sober marriage, and that's been a great blessing. I'm very, very grateful. There have been some less traumatic things happen in the past few months. I turned 50 in February and been going through menopause for the last 3 years. And this is not an easy thing for somebody like me because, I'm 50 years old and got the mind of a 12-year-old. And it's hard. I don't know how I'm supposed to be acting or anything. But my daughter and my babies gave me a fabulous birthday party in February. And just the place was just filled to overflowing with love and friends and people from Alcoholics Anonymous, all the family that I have there and the beloved people that mean so much to me and friends from the past. And that was just a joy. It was a joy. There wasn't anybody in that room that I hadn't made peace with. And there were the only person really not, there were several people who couldn't come, but my younger brother. My older brother and I have made peace, and that's something I'll talk about briefly in a few minutes. But my younger brother wasn't there, and he and I are still struggling. And I think he's probably the only person from my past that I still have struggles with, and I'm not struggling with him. He just still can't let go. I was like the storm that flew through here this morning. That could have had Marcia written all over it. The unleashing that fury of all that rage and anger and stuff. And I kind of went through people's lives that way. And the only thing I got from him, though, for my birthday, he left me a message on my answering machine at home and said, "God loves you, and I'm trying." So, there's hope. There's hope. At least he's acknowledging that God loves me, whether he does or not. But I'm still writing thank you notes. I've had so many things go on, and so many people have been so good to me and so loving and kind. And it seems like lately I'm just continually writing thank you notes for something. And I was raised to write thank you notes when somebody does something kind for you or you do something good for them. But I've always said that I think that's why Southern women don't get involved in orgies too much, because it'd be too many thank you notes to write, so like just a lot of work involved here. But I am grateful to be here, and I got this ragged big book sitting up here. Somehow I feel comfort when I touch this book because it's just beyond magic sitting in this book. But I am grateful to be here, and I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything that you've given me, and I look forward to the future. I do tend to dwell in the past sometimes because I can look and see, and not in a bad way. Because as I grow older, I love Rosa. I loved hearing her last night. She's one of those people that when she was drinking, she would have been one of my heroes. Because I think I just always want to be like somebody like Rosa. But I think they're changing the rules on me, and I always thought I was pretty hip, but I'm not at all. I can't keep up with things. But and I look forward to Dawn. I don't necessarily hang out with Al-Anons. I'm not intimidated easily, but Al-Anons, everyone I run into, I get a little nervous inside. I kind of draw up, a little bit. But and the rest of the weekend, everybody else, I'm anxious to be a part of this. But when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I to say that I was bankrupt spiritually, morally, and in every way is really an understatement. And I thought at that time that I knew the four horsemen, the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and all of these things, the anxiety. But and I thought at that point in time that I had reached a bottom of life that I couldn't possibly ever come back from. I didn't know, though, that I hadn't really hit a bottom, and I wouldn't hit a bottom until I came into the program and stayed here for a while. And that's where I really hit bottom, because the best friends I'd ever had and the only thing that had kept me alive had been taken from me, and I had really done absolutely nothing to replace that. And I believe so completely today that unless I replace what alcohol did for me, then with something that's going to keep me going, then I'm going to drink again. I know that without question. I know that I have had moments, and even lately, that I've had that feeling, not that I wanted to take a drink of alcohol, that doesn't enter my mind, but I've had many moments of wanting relief, and that's what I drank for, was to get relief, to get the relief that I have absolutely had to have, because I'm one of these people who doesn't function very well in this world. I never have. I remember I grew up, I was born and raised here in Atlanta. I've never left Atlanta. That's one of those things I couldn't identify when I came in the program. I couldn't identify with you because I'd made no geographic cures. This was one of the few consistent things in my life that I had lived here. I went away to school for a couple of years to Auburn, but as far as actually living somewhere else by choice, I never did. But I was born and raised in Atlanta, and I truly was. When I look back over my past and when I look at my family and everything in perspective, and I can do that today, get some perspective on my life, I can see that I did not have a horrible childhood as I had perceived it to be. And to hear me tell it, though, a few years into this program, you would have just thought it was just really one of these sad, serious cases that makes you want to cry. But it wasn't really that way, because I came from a really good family. And I say a good family because they were very moral. There was a lot of integrity, and there is to this day. My parents are in their 80s, and they practice some principles today that they've always practiced, and they do the things that they've always done, and they can withstand, and they've been through some terrible times. But somehow it didn't take with me, and it was not it was evident early on that I wasn't like the rest of the world. I felt like I'd been dropped in from outer space into a family that I didn't fit into, didn't particularly care for, and just in society in general, I couldn't function. And I got memories way back, way, way, way back to early days. Everything was negative. I saw all of the downside of everything. My daddy's a Southern Baptist preacher, so that ought to tell you something right there, in that preacher's kids do have a tough time, because we have standards to meet that almost are impossible sometimes. He's a good man, though, and I learned service work, and I know today when I look back at the service he did that I resented so, because I thought it was taking something away from me. But, of course, there were rules in our family. When you're raised like that, there are definite rules. Well, with any organization that is seeking spiritual, you know, spirituality demands discipline and demands structure. But I resented all of it, and I, as a little girl, seemed to be that way. And I formed a lot of patterns in my early days, my youth, very young, that I've kind of honed and refined, and they became known as character defects, but they got me through life. And one of the best things that ever happened to me, one of the greatest reliefs I ever had, was when I was 9 years old. And that's when I took my first drink. And I drank for 25 more years. Rosa mentioned amphetamines. She didn't particularly like them. And I only mentioned this morning because the drug addiction played a powerful role in my denial of my alcoholism. But I was addicted to amphetamines for 25 years, too. So if you can imagine, now I'm not on speed today. I mean, it's like, why did I take speed? I'm just always all the time anyway. I just never understood that. But anyway, that was kind of, you know, and I had the first drink. I remember a friend of mine's mother had it was an iced tea glass of bourbon sitting on a table, and she asked me if I wanted a drink, just to take a sip. And I said, yeah, sure. And I do remember. I remember of course I remember that feeling. We all know that feeling when you take a drink of alcohol, just that charge that goes over you. But I also remember how I felt afterwards. And that feeling, just I was going to spend the rest of my life, it seemed, it was 25 more years, trying to keep that feeling going. because when I drank alcohol, I was happy. And when I drank, I felt free and I felt comfortable. I was optimistic. I was peaceful. That was a key word to me. There was an inner peace that could come on about me. I could be a part of. That was the most glorious thing about alcohol to me, was that once I would take a few drinks, then I could, all of a sudden, I could be everything that I wasn't. And I've heard that the definition of a character defect is something that's lacking, that's necessary for completion. I felt like there was nothing to hear. There was nothing. I couldn't do it. I couldn't function. I couldn't be. I didn't know. I couldn't fit in. I was awkward. All of these things. But when I took a drink, and at that early age even, everything would come together and my mind could clear and I could just flow. And that's the way it would go for a long time until it turned on me. I am forever grateful for alcohol because it kept me alive long enough to get to you people. And you know, if it still worked today, my gosh, but there came a time, like for all of us, when we crossed that line, when it doesn't work anymore. And there's where real terror set in for me. Because this had worked for me. It had kept me alive. It had kept me from, even though there were lots of suicide attempts and lots of doctors wanting to commit me and different things like that, I still had alcohol. So my life revolved around alcohol. And the amphetamines I would take, because there was a difference in how they affected me. As you know, they are different. This is not all one big disease. But where I could be comfortable and people wouldn't scare me and nobody intimidated me and I could flow and be a part of when I drank. When I'd take the amphetamines, I had this thing from early on, never being quite enough. That was always the thing, and it is to this day, never quite measuring up. Of course, my standards for what I was trying to measure up to or what I thought you wanted from me were no human being could do that. But I thought I had to, and my daddy expected things from us kids, of course, to succeed and to be smart and to make A's and to do all these things. And I did these things. I would try, but I never felt a part of, good enough, or whatever. Well, when I take those drugs, you see, they keep going for just, you can go for days and weeks and months and never do slow down. And like you said, you just do everything. Watch the light bulbs on the ceiling and, you know, somebody said your eyes make it to the next room before you do and your mouth's just going and you think you're so smart. But I could be self-contained. Alcohol would lower that bridge to you and I could flow with you, but when I took the drugs I could draw that bridge back and I didn't need anybody. So I'd led that dual life and I spent my life that way, and everything else was secondary, absolutely secondary. And as a result, when I came to the program in the next 2 years after I got into the program, I lost every dream I'd ever hoped to achieve, that I had worked so hard for, that my family had hoped for me. I wrecked people's lives. I was just a miserable human being, and it just permeated. It's like a poison that just permeated everybody who came into my path. And I always thought, this is not what I wanted, but what's happened? When I came here and you told me I was an alcoholic, that was the furthest thing from my mind. I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. Not only because I've been a Baptist preacher's daughter, and there was never a drop of alcohol served in my home, so I didn't come from an alcoholic immediate family. Now, there were alcoholics in the family, no doubt about it, but that word was not used. They were just curious. That was a good word, curious people. And crazy was always a good word, and I got by with that. People would let you say you were crazy, and they'd treat you crazy, but it was like if you said you were an alcoholic. In fact, when I went into treatment, my mother told me that she had told Daddy that I had gone into treatment for depression and drug addiction. But she said I didn't mention that other thing because it just wasn't there, you know. So I kind of had that in my mind. And like I said, the drug addiction was a powerful tool for me because that's the way I saw myself. I denied the alcoholism, too, because that word was so foreign to me. But anyway, I did start drinking early, and it became a part of my life, and I loved beer, and I loved bourbon. I just loved bourbon. I just like to look at a bourbon. I like to just look at these things. Even today, I can see a Jack Daniels bottle or George Stickland's. You know, but it was just, I remember the feelings, the relief, the absolute relief. When I was dry, the few times, I don't remember very many times that I didn't have a chemical of some sort in my body in all those years. But when I wasn't drinking, I was what the book says, irritable and cross. And I had this sense of impending doom and always just this fear, just a fear that would just eat me alive. But once I took that drink, oh, There was such relief. And that word, relief, from myself. See, there's never been another human being in my life, and I've been involved with some difficult people in my life, but there's never been anybody who was so cruel and so demanding and so vicious and so killing as I was for myself. When the books tell us that we at some time in the past have made decisions based on self that have set us up to be hurt, and that fear is it, weren't we the cause? That's absolutely the total truth. The total truth. But I never saw it that way until I got into this program, and it has taken years of studying the steps and being involved and listening to people and really hearing who the problem was and where the problem lay. And it was inside of me, completely inside of me. It was my response to everybody else. But anyway, I grew up with this sense, and when I began to drink and I began to get my little friends in place, and I smoked cigarettes, started smoking when I was 9, you know. That, and I remember Daddy gave me the beating of my life over that one. He said, "Young lady, maybe this will stop this." I was 9 years old. Well, I still got a scar on my leg today from that whipping, but I never quit smoking, for heaven's sakes. It's just everything. I went underground with everything and lived that kind of life. I went into high school, and I continued to drink, and I got involved in, I became a part of a shoplifting ring. I became a prostitute. All of these things, everything, every moral principle that I had been taught or that I saw in society that was right, I completely violated every single principle that had been given to me. And the shame, and the guilt, and the remorse, and the fear of being found out always followed me everywhere I went, and in every situation I found myself. And waking up with people I didn't know and in places that I shouldn't be, and having that feeling that I want to say, this isn't right, but once I could take that drink, then it didn't make it okay, but it just somehow neutralized all of this. And this is the way my life began to revolve and to go on. And I can see that the alcoholism was full blown by the time I was 15 years old. And there was no question then of where I would go and the path I would take. And the path I would take would be to the gutter. I spent those teenage years just drinking any chance I could and involved in sex and stealing and lying, cheating, doing anything that I could possibly do. And not necessarily enjoying it, but I thought I did. I thought it was something that I wanted to do. But it just seemed to be the only way of life that I could latch on to and feel comfortable in. The other way, I just couldn't. And God, as far as I was concerned, I made a big declaration when I was 16 years old, one of the first of my declarations that I was of independence. I graduated from high school when I was 17. I'd skipped a grade. I had been real smart in school, and I had been bored and didn't fit in. I could fit in. I worked well with anybody. I mean, I could get along with anybody, but I didn't feel a part of any place. And I wanted to get out of high school. Maybe if I go on to college, everything will be wonderful. There's always something waiting. There's always something waiting for me somewhere. I graduated from high school and went to Auburn, and I spent two horrendous years there. I've always told the story, and it's just a really sick story, but it's always humorous to me simply because I got involved with the Auburn football team, and I don't need to tell you any more than that, except that they had a losing season that year, and I don't... But, you know, and I drank and I partied and I did all this stuff, and my grades just sank, and Daddy called me and told me I had to come home because he had not sent me there for that. He'd sent me there to get an education. And so didn't work either. I tried to join a sorority. I wasn't a part of that. That's just another planet. Never could feel a part of. Just drifting through this life. And, you know, we talk about a kit of spiritual tools, and we do have those today. And I do know for a fact today that any problem that comes my way, absolutely anything so far, and I hadn't had a new problem in a long time. If you stop and think about it, there are no new problems. They're just variations of old things. But I have tools today that I can use, and I've got the most glorious tools. I have a sponsor who I just respect so much, and that's so important that I've got somebody that I can respect who's got standards higher than mine, so that and she's been so fantastic because she has never once even begun to think of lowering her standards to meet mine. I've always had to come up to hers, and I have the steps and the women in my life and all of the people who've helped me in the program and principles that I've been taught. But anyway, I came home from Auburn, and I didn't know exactly, you know, what I was supposed to do, but I came home, and what I was saying, though, about the toolbox, that just reminded me of a favorite saying of mine that I thought about a long time ago. I have these things today, but at that point in time, I failed at school. I mean, I really had to come home, and I graduated from Georgia State eventually. But the only tool in my toolbox at that point in time was a hammer. And every problem looked like a nail to me. Well, have you ever thought about how you take a hammer and beat a nail to death? You can just ruin things. I tore a wall down one time, literally, with a hammer and a nail, because I was using the wrong kind of nail, and the wall fell down. That's kind of the way I was hitting life. I was just approaching life on those terms. And I came home, I went to Georgia State, and I got graduated with degrees in history, political science, sociology, and psychology. Now, it's nothing to do with me being a very brilliant person. What it had to do with was my daddy, trying to please daddy, somehow to hear him say, "Marcia, I am so proud of you, just like you are. This is wonderful. You have made me proud." That out of one of those fields, I could find something to do. Because I didn't know why I just drifting through this life, just like that storm this morning, just sailing on through, trying to do what I'm supposed to, but not having the power within me to take the right road. It was always going the other way, but not having the power. Personal powerlessness, I can relate that to the minute I was born. Absolutely. I always thought it was you and that the circumstances surrounded me, but it was just I didn't have any power within me, or I had it there but didn't know it. But anyway, the day I graduated, he came up to me, and here I had all these degrees, and he said, "You should have gone into business." Well, you can imagine what that feels like. So, and he meant well, but anyway, I went into business eventually. You know, I'm going to do what daddy says do. One day I'm going to get this. One day I'm going to feel that I'm okay. Looking on the outside, trying to find it on the outside. But I married a man around the time I graduated. He was the right man. My addictions called for me to marry this man because he eventually, I would come to know, would be my caretaker. I was a petulant child, and he would raise me well. He was good looking. He was extremely talented, extremely intelligent, and would be a good provider. And this is what I needed. And he's a good man, and he's still bitter to this day with the havoc that I wreaked in his life. But this is what we do. And, the minute I married him, that feeling went. I thought, this is going to do it. Didn't do it. I had a child 3 years later. And I thought, this is going to fill me up. This is the right thing to do. This is what normal people do. And the minute they brought that baby girl to me, I looked in her and I thought, what am I going to do? I don't know how to be a mother. I had no feeling at all. And those were painful times for me because there was nothing that could fill the holes that just seemed to be just an endless pit in my gut. And always looking for something. And I opened a business. And I tried hard in that business, and I ran it well. And I'm a good salesperson because I can zero in on people immediately and discover their weaknesses, really, is what it used to be. I could find out immediately what they needed and go for it. And the store succeeded because I gave my whole life to it. Everything I was going to be, I was going to make my mark with that store. Well, eventually that fell through because it was burglarized. And we lost everything we had. There was several hundred thousand dollars lost of financial loss. And, the burglary, and because we didn't have an insurance policy, had lapsed. And my husband hadn't renewed it. We thought it was renewed. All these things were going on. And this is just, and life's just moving on. But I had alcohol to keep me going, to keep me a part of, to keep me sane. But I began to notice that I wasn't in control anymore. And I used to have supreme control over my life, and I could manage things. But I began to notice that I didn't want the parties that I would have and the parties I would go to. and all the places that I would be that I wasn't supposed to be. It wasn't feeling quite right anymore. And I'd look, get up and look around me, and I didn't want to be with these people, and I wanted to isolate. And all these things start happening. That's alcoholism and the progression. And I began to shut myself off from the world, and eventually would lose it all. I would lose my husband, my child, my home, my business, and everything that I had ever worked for. But this continued, and this is just pretty much, you know, the way it went with me. And in the late 70s, I began to become one more time the suicidal. And there were several suicide attempts. They would always come at Christmas in the fall of the year, because there was a depression there that would stay with me until springtime. I've been waiting for the spring to come, because it's still with me sometimes, and spring doesn't seem to want to come. But you know, this is just it, and they didn't work. I couldn't live and I couldn't die. All these things that we all know about and we experience at some point in time. I'd had nervous breakdown after nervous breakdown to say, but I thought I'd had the last one, and I think it was the last really complete breakdown. In May of 1981, I was sent to see a doctor who was particularly, he was a messenger of God, as these people tend to be, and I recognize all of you as the same, because he told me that I was an alcoholic. And I was just absolutely stunned. I had read every book. I had studied everything. I had just tried every way in the world to understand what and who I was. And that was the most foreign word that I had ever heard. It couldn't possibly be. And I had all the excuses that I carried into this program, that why I wasn't like you, why I was different, and that you didn't understand. But I went into a treatment center in Pennsylvania. He insisted that I go away from home. He didn't even want me here in Atlanta. And nobody else wanted me here either, I can tell you that. But I went up there and I stayed there, and as we do in treatment centers, we begin to, I loved it up there. I just absolutely loved this controlled environment. Why wouldn't I? But I did stay there for 6 weeks, and I stayed as sick there because I was in detox longer than usual because I was so sick when I went in there. But once I got to coming to physically, you know, the first thing that returns for all of us is our ego. It is for me anyway, the first thing to get better or to recover. And my ego began to recover because here I am in Pennsylvania and they think the southern accent and all this stuff is so charming. Well, boy, that's a green light for me to just take on off and go. So the old self just comes right back up, the self that's there anyway. And I'm just breezing through, having a great time in treatment, for heaven's sakes. And I just loved it. I thought it was wonderful. And that when I came home, everything that I'd left behind, all the destruction and the havoc and the chaos, would be gone. But of course it's not gone. I came back to a living hell because the debts had piled up. My child was so emotionally disturbed by that time. She was having to see a doctor. My marriage was falling apart. My family, there was absolutely no connection with my family at all anymore. My friends had all, they were just scratching their head. Everybody, you know, but they finally all got real tired. Because life's too short to have to live this way. And I'm real grateful, really, for all the people who eventually got to that place where they just weren't going to put up with me anymore. I came to you, though. I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I wasn't an alcoholic necessarily, I sure did like the feeling I got when I came to these meetings. I remember the first meetings that I came to, and the love and the caring and the laughter and all of the good things that we find in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it felt good because it felt like a shelter, a safe haven from out there and all those people. I wanted them off my back. And you actually welcomed me here. You wanted me here. You listened to me. You seemed to care, and you didn't throw me out. It was the first place I've been in a long, long time that people didn't just not want me to be in the same room with me, because I was a very scary person by that time. During those last days of drinking, I had become violent at home, and the anger and the rage had come out, and I had begun to try to kill my husband. I remember chasing him with knives and with a pair of scissors one night. I don't know what I was going to cut, but anyway, I went after him like that, and I had just become a very frightening person, and I would lash out and hit out at anybody who would be in my path. But I came in here, and there was a sense of relief, and I got a sponsor immediately, and I will always be grateful to her, because the first thing she did for me was simply to get me to come to meetings and to be a part of, and she would take me places. And that's one treasure. I will never, I can never have enough gratitude for her, because she did do these things for me. I was not a good sponsoree, and so she couldn't be a good sponsor to me because I wasn't willing to listen. I didn't open the books. I didn't care. I did the best thing I knew, the only thing I knew, because I was a liar and a cheat and a thief. I was living like a drunk, thinking like a drunk. I just wasn't drinking. But I did the only thing I knew to do, was to get involved with a mind-altering, mood-changing man. And that's what we do. You know, a lot of women do that. A lot of men do that, too. But that would at least take my mind off of where I was. And it was a good distraction for a couple of years. I grew to resent that man tremendously because he was 12 years sober and I was 1 month. And if you're hitting on newcomers and you've been around this program for a while, just stop doing it, because, you know, it's like hitting a wounded bird. But back then, you know, I thought it was just wonderful because he's going to help me. Well, it turned out he did help me. He helped me to get finally to the bottom, to the absolute bottom of the heap, where I would wake up and look in the mirror and feel a really experienced terror, bewilderment, frustration, anxiety, and incomprehensible, but by that time, comprehensible demoralization, because I was sober. I hadn't had a drink, and yet I was just looking in the mirror and thinking, well, you can't live sober and you can't live drunk, and you're a sorry human being. And what a sorry state of affairs. I had been hanging around this program, and I did get involved and do certain things and all those things that people tell you to do, and you think it's stupid, what's it got to do with anything? But I would make coffee, and I was the cake lady for the Tucker group. I was so proud of that, because I got to order the cakes for the birthdays on Friday night. And being grandiose and dramatic as I am, I would have a theme cake every month. There would always be, you know, April we'd have an umbrella, and June we'd have a June bug or something like that, and a flag for the 4th of July. But that's okay, because that was involved, and I liked that. I liked being involved. But I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker, hanging out with this man, not working any steps, lying to my sponsor, spreading myself around, and going to every meeting, telling every problem I ever had, and couldn't wait to raise my hand to tell you my problem of the day. And that's why today I just hate meetings when somebody opens it up with, "Has anybody got a problem?" Don't we all? And anyway, things just progressed and got a lot worse. Life got a lot worse. And I lost just everything, finally lost everything. I know today that any problems that do come up today have their roots in the past. I've learned that in the 8th step. They have their roots in the past, but I know I cannot solve those problems today with the same thinking that I created the problems with before. And that goes back again to that made decisions based on self to set us up to be hurt. And thank God that you people have reprogrammed my mind and reprogrammed my thinking through actions, through doing things that had nothing to do seemingly with this program. But my thinking had to be changed, but the only way it would happen would be if I did things. Anyway, finally, the day came where the disease had progressed. I was not drinking, but the disease had progressed to the point that I had it. I couldn't stand it anymore. I was emotionally ill. I had always been mentally ill. I have certificates declaring me perfectly mentally ill. I am a perfect case, and the titles, the schizophrenic, the schizoid alienation, all of these things, and obsessive compulsive, and you can see that as I'm wiggling these hands up here, but just, you know, all these things, I had all of this, and it was just finally clear. I am just totally crazy, and I don't know what I'm going to do. But the Atlanta Roundup in July of 1983 was my, right after my second birthday. Barbara had insisted, by the way, Barbara was a good sponsor, because she told me the only prayer, she got it simple with me because I was so sick and so stupid. She would say, "Marcia, okay, let's don't say any lengthy prayers in the morning. Just get up and say, God divorced me from self-pity. Just say that. Do what you don't want to do and don't do what you want to do." She told me something one time I thought was the rudest thing I'd ever heard, and just cruel, but she said, "If it doesn't affect your breathing, it's not a problem, Marcia." Well, you know, things like that she would tell me, but she kept it real simple. But one other thing she would do, she would make me go to the Atlanta Roundup. I'd been to one, and I didn't know all these people, but I would cling to her, and she made me get involved and go into things and go into meetings. But this was the second Roundup, and I said, "All right." And she said, "You better be there." Well, for some reason, I would listen to that, but I just thought, no more. And that clarity that comes when we make decisions, you know, I made that decision, no more. I'm going this weekend, but tomorrow, Sunday, I'm out of here. I don't know what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to drink, whether I'm going to take a gun and blow my brains out, but I'm out of here. Well, this is the importance of coming to these things, of showing up at meetings. Tony helped me so much when I was early on, young in this program, because I didn't know how to pray. I had never put God first in my life, so therefore I had deprived myself of all of his help. But you told me I was going to have to get some connection there. Well, I didn't know how to do it, so you were it. And Tony one night was at a meeting with me, and I heard him say that he comes into a meeting and he'd stop and say, I'm going to listen tonight and see what God's got on his mind for me today. Well, that was the way I listened to God, but I'd listen to you people. But I went to that roundup that particular night, and I had learned to go. And I remember sitting there. I remember that night so vividly because it was the night that my life began to change forever, and the transformation would take place. But I sat there, first thinking, just counting the minutes till I could get out. And there was a speaker that night who absolutely was the one, and we all have special people, I believe, certain individuals that God does indeed give the message to that gets through to us, where we have the ears to hear and we finally do hear. But he began to talk, and as he began to talk, I remember I began to shake, and something began to happen inside of me, and I thought, I've heard it for 2 years, but I'm hearing it now for the first time. And it was talking about alcoholism and what it really meant, and it began to hit me that it is not when I am drinking, because when I was drinking, there were problems big time. The world around me was totally destroyed as a result of my alcoholism and my drinking and the things that I did and the problems that it caused. But what the problem was within me, that I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and needed to take a drink again to get that ease and comfort and the relief. Or else that's what an alcoholic does. And I began to hear it that night, and I will be eternally grateful. This man became a mentor to me, and I've got every tape he ever because I could hear him. I could hear him because he did talk about feelings and emotions, and he talked about all of insanity and the way we can be, and that those of us who are so oversensitive and just mentally not on balance just can't get anything right in their life. But I began to listen that night, and I was just charged, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And the next few months were literal hell for me. I know now that was the beginning, but as it with any surgery, with any bad thing that happens, there has to be a time that's even worse than the initial feeling. And I went through the next 6 months suffering terribly, because I knew then what the problem was, that I was an alcoholic, and I began to understand what it meant. But by 6 months after that, my daughter one day said something to me, and it was something very minor, something very just like a teenage kid would say, and I completely fell apart. It just went berserk one more time, and I went to my closet in my bedroom, and my husband had left by then, and we were living in a dump over in Morningside. I had absolutely nothing left, no job, no husband. My child would eventually leave me to live with him, because I was hell to live with at any time. And there was a loaded gun in the corner, and I pulled the gun out. And I had tried suicide, overdoses, and different things, and running my car off of bridges at times before. But this particular day, I pulled the gun out of the closet, and I had a real sense of relief, because I knew how I could kill myself, and I knew that I could do it. I went in the other room, and I pulled that gun out, and I stuck it to my head, and I pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off. It was just that simple. I'd never been around a gun. I didn't know what to do with it, but I just knew. I just pulled the trigger, and it was loaded. I called her up, and that's what I know today, the miracle of that connection. I believe a third step when we pick up a telephone, that's part of a third step. But I know that today. And I called her, and she came to me, and we got on our knees. I'd never been on my knees to pray. And she said, just God help her. God help her. And we began to pray together. And I was completely down and defeated at that point. My sobriety has been incredible since then. My life has been incredible, only because of you people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. At that moment in time, I gave up. My third step was simply throwing my hands. And the next few years, I would go through all the material loss and the family loss and all of the things that come with the disease, all of the destruction of my past caught up with me. But I began to get active in the meetings. I got a new sponsor. I married a man who had helped me so much. And in fact, he was the only man I'd ever known who didn't want something from me that I wasn't willing really to give. He was a spiritual man, and he cared about this program, and he knew about the steps. And the first thing he told me was that I need to go to step meetings. I needed to learn to read the literature. literature of this program, and to not read anything else, and to put all my life, and to get some priorities in my life. And that this program and my sobriety and my growth spiritually and a development of a relationship with a God, that, or at least let him come up from inside of me. I don't worry about trying to find him out there anymore. He's just buried alive under all of this stuff inside of me. But he taught me all of these things, and we went to meetings together, and it was a tremendous friendship, and it was based in completely in spirituality and our mental and our emotional state. And it eventually grew, though, that we fell in love, and we married. I was 4 years sober. He was 6 years sober. Like I said, tomorrow we'll have 12 years sobriety. And he's alive today. I could have been a widow 3 weeks ago. I'm so cynical, I thought I could have been a wealthy widow 3 weeks ago. You know, I had that for thought at one point. My thoughts haven't changed sometimes. I'm still selfish and self-centered. But I got involved, and Maggie had I asked Maggie to sponsor me. I was so afraid of this woman because I knew her reputation. But that's what I wanted. I wanted somebody who was going to take my inventory, who was going to be honest with me, who I would not allow me to debate with them, who would show me how they had recovered and would not support any of my old behaviors anymore. I needed somebody who could help me learn how to live sober. That's the issue, is how to live sober. We can learn everything, but doing it is a different story, and I didn't have a clue. And I am so grateful to her and for everything she did for me. I'm so grateful to Clancy for what he did for me. I am so grateful to the husband of mine who helped me so much. And then eventually I began to sponsor women myself. And this has been the greatest blessing of my life, because I've learned so much about myself through these women. Every time I sit down with another woman and we talk about her, I see me and I hear me and I hear what, as Tony says, God's got on his mind for me to change and to learn and to grow through. And this has been the experience for me. And it's 16 years later, and in the last 14 years, this is what I've been doing on a continuous basis. I started a lady step study 12 years ago, and I tell you what, it's the best meeting in this whole world. It's not just the best meeting in town. It's the best meeting in this whole world. And the reason is, I call it my meeting. I like that, you know, and I like to be the founder and all this stuff. And I get to start off every week and say, I get to open it up. But when I give it to God, is I hand it to him, but we start into the books. And that's his word. And it's not Marcia's opinion. It's his word. And we study the steps, and we take them, and we drag them out, and we study them. And that's the most powerful. Half of them aren't here today. Some of them are here, but the others are working. They, you know, we learn responsibility for ourselves, and darn if they didn't have to go to work and decide to choose work over coming with me today. But, you know, they've grown and they've changed, and I can see the beauty. And then they're sponsoring people. And that's the most wonderful feeling in this world, because it's the whole thing right there. One drunk sharing with another, and our lives are immeasurably, immeasurably changed and enriched and enhanced because of this connection that we have. And it is celebration. That's what it's all about. It's a celebration of a miracle. Life has been good to me. I've had several painful deaths happen in my life, and it is painful for me. God, the people I've loved the most have lost. It's just things have happened. My daughter and I, though, today, you know, this child that I just could not know how to raise. And if I have any regrets, it was the kind of parent I was, because I was not a good parent. I was a terrible parent. And I do have those moments. But I know that I've been forgiven. I've understood about forgiveness. My parents and I, oh, dear God, I resented them so. My older brother and I couldn't even speak or be in the same room together. My father, I just resented him so. And today I can be a loving, caring daughter. And the morning my sister-in-law died, I had the strength within me because of you that I could drive 100 miles and tell my parents that she was dead of a heart attack. And they had loved her more than they loved us, because she had loved them unconditionally, you know, and we all knew, and that was okay. But I could do that because of you. And I had you going with me, and you giving me that strength. You are my only strength. You are the only thing that keeps me going. So why would I ever want to leave this program? Why would I ever not want to keep a commitment that I make? And commitment to me means a lot different than it used to. Commitment used to mean papers and hospitals and chains and all this stuff. Today, it means life to me. And I will do what I say I'm going to do, and I'm going to be where I say I'm going to be, and you can count on it. You can trust me. And these women have trusted me into their life. They've opened their lives to me. I am so grateful for all of this. There's no way to talk about these things. There's no way to even begin to express it. I know today that, you know, and I get off on tears today so easy because I am an emotional firecracker here. I will just get, I get crazy. And I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I've realized the last few weeks I'm not a very good person. I'm not a good wife, and I'm not a good mother. I'm a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but Maggie says if you ain't working the program at home, you ain't working the program. So I have to keep going because, but I'm not a good person. But I know that it's more important to do right than to be right. And I have to remember those things. I have to keep this stuff in my mind. I have to continue to read the steps and continue to talk to other people and to get out of myself and to never say no to an AA request, because I have yet to do anything ask of me in Alcoholics Anonymous that has not helped me immeasurably. Maybe someday I'll grow up. I have no idea, but I know it's my responsibility. I know I'm responsible for me. I know that I'm the one who caused any failures in my life, and that it's my perception of things that's going to get me drunk or make me crazy. I know that today. There's no believing, there's a knowing. And that's so important to me, because sometimes it can really ruin a good resentment. I want sometimes to carry a resentment so bad I can't stand it. But all of a sudden, all this stuff starts coming. But you know, we got to keep going. And if you've been in this program a long time and you're not involved and you're just sitting around, my thing is that I know I'm on the right track. I know that. But if I just sit there, I'm still going to get run over. So I have to just keep coming and keep doing and keep working. And it's not having to as much as I want to. It's a glorious experience, and I don't want anybody to miss a miracle. And if you don't hang around and get involved and stay consistently with it, and as Tony says, go to a meeting, find out what God's got on his mind for you, because he's there to tell you. You got to show up. But I got to practice principles over personalities, and my personality is the one I got to practice principles over first. And that's what the steps have taught me to do. And, you know, to stay sane and sober today, I have to continue to do everything that I've ever done in the past, and to sometimes redouble my efforts as I have the last 4 months. The last 4 months have been the most painful months of my entire life inside of my heart and my soul, because I have a feeling heart and soul today, a caring heart. And I do so care about other people more so than myself sometimes, because I have been waked up to the fact that everybody, all of us are one, and we're all together in this thing, and I understand it too well. So it does hurt. But I know that when I have great joy, I'm going to have great pain, and I can accept that. But I do try to do the things that I've always done, and I continue to stay involved. And I have to get up every morning and do the prayer and meditation and read these little books. God bless him, everybody, for these books, whoever wrote them, because they are just, they get my thinking on a different plane, and my thinking can be pretty low sometimes. And the seven-step prayer, when I get up, I try to take that out of the door with me, and during the day when I get stuff. I work for the Georgia State Senate. I'm involved in politics. Isn't that a great place to be? If you want to feel superior mentally, go work with a bunch of politicians, because you know you almost feel sane. You almost feel like you've got it together when you're around them very long. We just finished the legislative session, and that was something else. But my prayers are always the same, and the prayer that I read every day of my life is, fill me, Lord, with peace at the very center of my soul in whatever circumstances I may find myself, so that I can continue to be of service to you and those about me. Bless me, Lord, with the peace that comes from knowing that I don't have to struggle to reach you. I don't have to succeed in anything to please you. And I don't have to do anything but belong to you and accept the love and peace that you want to give. When I'm particularly paralyzed in fear and pain, and these things come upon me, I love the line from the, be still and know that I am God. And I've learned to take it and say, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. Be still and be. That's just what I need. I need to be reminded on a regular basis, and to keep it simple. I need to know that this day after that storm, yesterday was the most beautiful day. May is always a beautiful month. And that storm came roaring through there this morning, and I thought, there's Marcia. They never named a hurricane Marcia, but they should. But tomorrow's probably going to be, the sun's going to be out again. Today's going to be just fine. One of the first things I say when I wake up every morning is, thank you, Lord, for letting me wake up. And I like And I want us all to carry out with us into this day. I know it probably made you a nervous wreck talking up here. I tend to do that with people, just talk. And Clancy told me one time that if he knew he had 24 hours to live, he'd want me right by his side because I can make it seem like an eternity. And that's probably the way you feel right now. But I am glad to be here, and I just appreciate it so much. But this is the day that the Lord has made, and let's do rejoice and be glad in it. And I thank you all for having me here and for putting up with me. And I know you're looking forward to the rest of the weekend. And I'm not going to eat any more power bars. I'm just going to go eat and have a good time and listen to the other speakers. And in closing, I just simply want to say, may the good Lord bless and keep you, and may he make his face shine to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. May he lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace, blessed peace. Thank you.